This is my first time to use PowerPoint, so we'll see how this goes. I've avoided it all these years. Let me tell you first that this is actually going to be a co-authored paper with my colleague Kirill Toshkov at TCU, and he's going to write the empirical part. I have written the theoretical part, so this is the theory. And then I fully expect to have to go back and change things on the theory section as he goes through and tries to apply the general model to various crises throughout the world, but we haven't got that part done yet, so this is just the theory section. And I thought before I started I'd give you a bit of an idea of why I decided to write this paper, because it's not really my usual area. I'm really more interested in exchange rates, which obviously is related. And as a post-Keynesian economist, crisis is not something that is unfamiliar to me. But, well, here's how it started. About 10 or 15 years ago, I decided, well, I think I might write a book on exchange rate determination from a post-Keynesian perspective. And I came up with this title. And I shared that idea with my wife. I said, I'm going to write this book, and this is what I'm going to call it. And this is what she said. She's a bit more of a marketer than I am, and she said, you know, if I'm walking through a bookstore and I see a book entitled "The Post-Keynesian Approach to Exchange Rate Determination," that would not cause her to want to walk over and pick up that book. So I said, okay. So point taken. So I then changed the title a bit, and I went with, how about a little alliteration in the title? You know, currencies and capital flow. So I got to keep my part of the title, "The Post-Keynesian Approach," but something a little bit catchier. And her reaction was that that's better. She liked that better. So I was encouraged by her approval here. I thought, well, why not have three words then? Currencies, capital flows, and crises. You know, especially with crises right there. It sounds very exciting, doesn't it? And actually, it just came out with Routledge this year. And as I recall, I believe this was her reaction. I don't remember exactly. But it was something along these lines right here. So, the problem was that there was nothing about crisis in the book at this point. And so, you know, and of course she was so excited about my title, what can I do? So now I have to write a section in the book on crisis. And in order to do this, let's see, where am I now? All right. And so, you know, again, as a post-Keynesian economist, you're not unfamiliar with crisis. So I had to go through and do it. But there's our cat there. He's passed away now, so this is a sad moment. What I did was I went through and read up as much as I could on, I sort of got a number of different crises, but I focused especially on the Mexican and Asian ones, and sort of tried to put together a general approach in the book, sort of a general theoretical approach. And in doing this, of course, you have the problem of definitions. What am I going to call a crisis? What sort of crises? For my own purposes, I decided to break things down into a Minsky crisis, which, you know, leads to debt default, a currency crisis, and an asset market crisis. And I read through, you know, a number of books, but also articles in the JPKE and the Cambridge Journal and the JDI, etc. And then I did, you know, I included those in the book. But it really only sort of whetted my interest in the area. I really didn't feel like I'd sort of exhausted everything, and I wanted to go back and have another look at these issues. And a couple of things that struck me as I was doing the chapters for the book. And so here today, the paper that I'm presenting has three goals, and it might be useful. I don't know. I'm thinking maybe I could balance this right here. It might be useful to keep these up here right there. The three goals of the paper. One, to show that all financial crises are manifestations of the same basic phenomenon. Two, to highlight an often overlooked factor. Three, to model crises in a way that allows you to see as much as possible everything at once. And then four, of course, is Kirill Toshkov's part of the paper. By the way, he's a neoclassical. So I'm using this project to bring him over to away from the dark side of the force and toward the light side. So very nice young man. He just came to our university a few years ago. But at this point, he is misguided. So let's see here. And so what I'll do is, in going over the paper, I'll go in order and cover each of these three. Let's see. But first, let me jump to the very end, because I want you to see, you know, where this is headed, because I think that makes it easier to follow. This is going to be the model at the end, all right? And again, you know, it looks kind of like, you know, oh yeah, if you go to Waterloo Station, you can get the district line here. And so at first it's a little bit, you know, it looks like a bit of a mess, and maybe that's because it is. But actually, I think that I was leaning heavily towards the ability to be able to see all these different sorts of crises emerging at the same time. A big reason was because in my reading of the various crises, it struck me that what particularly triggered a crisis was in some ways coincidental. It could have emerged anywhere else. I mean, for example, in the Asian financial crisis, well, there were problems of increasing levels of debt to income, and there were problems of overvalued assets in real estate, and there was a problem of overvalued currencies all at the same time. So what eventually caused, you know, what eventually was the historical factor that caused the tip over and the crisis was in some ways coincidental. It could have happened anywhere. It was emerging in a number of places at once. And so rather than, say, cross these two out and look just at Minsky, you're not seeing everything, because actually these things are evolving at the same time. First thing, and again, by the way, remember again, when Kirill does his part of the paper, I may find we need to go back and change things in the theoretical section. But I struggle with this. I think it's true. I struggled with this for a while. But I think that basically all financial crises are basically a manifestation of the fact that you have increasingly optimistic forecasts in a currency market, for example, the value of the currency, or in a Minsky crisis, your increasingly optimistic forecast is your forecast of how much debt you can carry. So, you know, that alongside economic forces that cannot possibly justify those expectations, I then broke down a crisis into three stages. There's the shock stage at which, and let's see, I believe I copied this down here. What is shock? Ah, yes. Shock is the point at which agents suddenly and dramatically conclude that their expectations were significantly out of line with reality. But then if you have this shock and then you go back to bed and say, I'll worry about it later, well, then really there's no economic problem. What happens is then, of course, you start, you know, panic selling off of assets, so you have negative repercussions for the economy, and then very often some sort of contagion. Now, this next here is my breaking down of various types of crises and what was the focus of expectations in that case and the negative repercussions and so forth. I'm actually not going to say much about this because I won't have time to go over what I think is the more interesting part of the paper. But and this is what I'm hoping when Kirill does his part, that they'll find out, oh yeah, that's exactly what happened. Or if not, we go back and change the theory section. So, let's see. Oh yes. That was number one. Show that, well, actually, I didn't show it, I just said it. All right. Say that all financial crises are manifestations of the same phenomenon was one. Two is highlight an often overlooked factor. Now, I'm very sympathetic to the articles and theories put forward by post-Keynesians on crisis, but there was one thing that bothered me throughout. Very common in these arguments was the idea that, yes, we have expectations that are pushing the expectation of profit this way so high that, you know, for example, in the asset market, you get expectations of future profits from financial assets go higher and higher and higher to the point that even a mundane event can lead people to conclude, oh, my expectations were well out of line with what is really being realized in the economy. But that, I didn't find that very satisfying. It was kind of like, well, the expectations go higher and higher and higher, and then something happens. And I didn't like the "and then something happens" because I don't think it's necessary. And as a matter of fact, this is something that Vicky Chick referenced in her plenary talk yesterday. Basically, the idea that in Keynes, and I won't go over the whole thing, but in Keynes, you have the idea that as firms invest, so we increase the stock of capital. And as we increase the stock of capital, the profitability of further investment goes down. So there's sort of a negative feedback loop. Investment rises, which, you know, as we build more and more restaurants, so the expected profitability of building a new restaurant goes down. And so you have the expansion and then the saturation of the stock of capital, and it goes down until people decide it's worthwhile building restaurants again. So we have an underlying cycle here, at least the way the macroeconomy is structured right now, an underlying cycle that's going to cause, during an expansion, not only during an expansion will the expectations of profit be going like this, while the realized profits, you know, having a larger and larger gap between them. But in fact, the realized profits will turn the other direction. So we have this, you know, gap getting larger and larger between the expectations and the realized profits, which makes the point of shock, how did I define that? The point at which agents suddenly and dramatically conclude that their expectations were significantly out of line with reality becomes more and more likely. So this is my overlooked factor, because I hadn't seen anybody mention that, and I thought it was important from a Keynes perspective to include this. Now, that's number two. So now we're down to number three, which is actually the longest one, and why I've left it for last year. Model the economy in a way that allows us to see everything, quote unquote, at once. And once again, I just wanted to toss this up here real quickly to make a point, and that is that, as I suggested before, I think all of these in any crisis tend to be emerging at the same time. You tend to be having a situation that is making a Minsky crisis more likely at the same time as you're having the asset market crisis more likely at the same time as you're having the currency market crisis more likely. So, anyway, I think it's important to see all three at once. Right? So what I want to do now is to... Oh, let me check. I discovered the stopwatch function on my cell phone. It's very exciting. 11 minutes and 39 seconds. All right. What I want to do now is say a few words about this and about this, and actually not so much about that. The Minsky crisis. This is the way I decided to model that. It's a very well-known phenomenon. But, for example, rising GDP will lead to rising incomes, which then allows people to meet debt repayment schedules. And as they do so, they become more confident. You know, common story. As they do so, they become more confident, which then makes them think, oh, well, I can carry even more debt. The problem being, of course, that this link right here is overly optimistic, that as they are able to meet these debt repayment schedules, then their estimated ability to service debt gets out of line with what they really can service. And so they take on more and more debt. And now we have, the way I sort of modeled each crisis was with a tension point. There's a tension point between income and the debt burden here. And as income gets larger and larger relative to this, so it's more likely that at some point, if you picture, so, you know, taking a piece of wood and, you know, creating tension right here, at some point it snaps. And when it snaps, that, you know, that's when you have the crisis. And if you go back to my, what do they call it? Often overlooked factor? Yes, often overlooked factor. Not only is this rising during an expansionary period, but also at some point this is going to start turning the other way. If we have the saturation of the stock of capital and then firms lower investment and so the economy contracts. So we have this rising and that falling and a tension point emerging right here. Then, pardon me, in the asset market, the way I decided to model this was, all right, let's say we have a period, it doesn't have to be rising GDP. I mean, it could be, for example, in a developing economy, it could be the excitement created by the liberalization of the capital market, which then all of a sudden causes, you know, capital flow in. There's some jump in, say, real economic, realized profits. The realized profits of those who are issuing the assets. For example, Exxon profits go up. Well, when Exxon profits go up, then the price of their stock goes up. But then when the price of their stock goes up, people begin to think, oh, it's a good deal to buy Exxon stock. Well, you know, don't know much about Exxon, but it looks like the price of their stock just went up. I should get in on that because there's some really good profits in owning financial assets. And so then you get what happens over here after the initial impulse from the realized profits increasing. You get a positive feedback loop in here as I expect the profits to go up, so I buy the asset, which drives the price up, which then confirmed my hypothesis that I was going to make profit from buying Exxon stock, which then makes even more people jump on the bandwagon. And so you get this process over here. You get something of a shift from, say, sort of an enterprise-based pricing of the asset to speculation over here. And then the tension point here emerges between what we expect to what profit we expect from these financial investments versus the profits that are being reported by the issuing entity. And at some point when that quarterly report comes out and it says that, oh yeah, Exxon made 10%, but we were expecting them to earn 50%, then that's when the, you know, tension point snaps and we have a crisis. That's also why you lie about how much profit you're making. That's why you get your accounting company. Who was it that Enron took down with them?
Anderson.
Yeah, that's why you have your accounting company lie for you, because you realize that what people are expecting and what you're showing on your books are quite a long way apart. Let's see. About 4 minutes and 30 seconds. This is the currency part, and it's much more complicated. So I decided it was best not to go over this, ironically, since actually my initial reason for doing all this was to talk about currency markets. But it's a lot more complicated. Particularly, I actually have a different one. I have a whole different chart for when you have a fixed exchange rate system, a pegged exchange rate, then it creates some very different tension points. But let me just say this about it. For all intents and purposes, what we have there is just another manifestation of the asset market that really is, you know, financial capital flows that's driving the exchange rate. And so the exchange rate is really just another financial asset and part of the whole asset market crisis. So going back to this, you put all three together, the three different crises, and then the overlooked factor. And what I wanted to point out here, you've seen this three times now, and I expect you to be able to recreate it. You probably see it tonight when you close your eyes in bed. You can actually add a couple extra things because there's some interactions here. For example, as the stock of capital is saturated and the opportunities for some real profit goes down, well, then you have firms saying, well, let's put some money into wealth management, which can also contribute to this process over here by bidding up of asset prices. Furthermore, while these real profit opportunities are going away, the bankers who have been loaning the money are looking for another place to make loans, and so they perhaps go into some very the subprime crisis was fresh in my mind. So yeah, have this aggressive debt marketing on the part of banks, which can contribute to the rising debt to income. So you see, this contributes in more than just through the level of economic activity. There's also reasons to believe that as you saturate the real profit opportunities, so you have firms moving into debt wealth management over here, and you have banks moving into aggressive debt marketing. Meanwhile, while your currency is becoming overvalued, you think to yourself, well, I should borrow in dollars. Because our currency is so valuable, we borrow more and more money in dollars, which creates a whole set of problems I haven't even modeled here. But that creates a link over here. And John Harvey's exciting conclusion, which I did not share with my wife, so I do not have a slide showing her reaction, but let's see here. Root cause of financial crisis is the initially gradual and eventually rapid separation of expected returns from what the real economy can actually generate. Ultimately, evidence of the relative underperformance of the non-financial sector will become known, and then shock, negative repercussions, and contagion result, and depending on the magnitude, terrible things can happen. Let's see here. Oh, and the last thing here, it's a function of the structure of the market economy, and it does not require crony capitalism, government interference, et cetera, et cetera. Very, very post-Keynesian, I think. Thank you.